Okay, let's go ahead and see if we can come in and get started. Charles and I thought we might try something a little different this afternoon. Quitting on time. We'll just see how it goes. I've gotten through almost all the questions that I have, and I didn't check the box just now, so hopefully there's nothing in it. I did get a question last week, and I just held it because I wanted to deal with this week, and now it's Friday, and I need to get to it. The question was, how did the church develop great leaders in the past? And then, is it the responsibility of the home or the church? Well, I'll answer the second one first. Is it the responsibility of the home or the church to develop good leaders? Well, the answer is yes. It's the responsibility of both. And I don't hardly think you can do it without one or the other. If I would go through some of the things we've tried to discuss this week, I'd say the church developed great leaders of the past. I don't know if that meant first century or 100 years ago. I probably know a little bit more about the first century because we have the Bible, but there was the installing of courage that we talked about. There was the element of delegating. And there was, I think, the making of the awareness of how badly it is needed in the church. I will say one way in which in the first century they did not develop leaders was sending them to a Bible college or to a seminary, and there's a reason for that. Some people say, well, any place I can get a good idea, I'm willing to go there. Well, that's not me. There's a lot of places that have some good ideas that I don't want my name associated with. But we're going to talk about this, so as I guess this first segment is really dealing with this question, but I was going to deal with this section anyway, because developing leaders is important. And we come down to some basic questions. Are good leaders born or are they made? Is leadership a teachable element? Well, I guess I must believe it has some teachable elements to it, or I probably would have declined this topic for 2 weeks. But I do believe that there is an element of hereditary or inborn nature that makes leadership easier for some people. And I'm talking about kind of the official form or more effective leaders. I think we all are leaders in some way. But I think it is easier for some people to be good or great leaders. But I think there are teachable elements to it. But I think leadership development should be an ongoing process in our lives as well as in the lives of the next generation that we're seeking to prepare. And I think most of us should have multiple mentoring relationships. And that's not simply a tree in which you're mentoring five people instead of one. I'm talking about most of us ought to still have some people who are mentoring us while concurrently we are in the process of mentoring some that maybe are a little younger or less experienced than we are. Because we have to have people who will eventually replace us in leadership. John the Baptist was right. I must decrease so that he may increase. And we should reach out intentionally to develop people in leadership because it will not just happen. Now, some congregations have been lucky. In my opinion, they have probably done hardly nothing to develop leaders, and leaders have risen from their ranks. If you're in a congregation like that, consider yourself very, very lucky. Most times, if congregations and we as adults don't do things to develop the next generation of leaders, our congregations dwindle, die, suffer, whatever. Because I do not think it happens simply automatically. Sheila Staley, in one of her books, talking about mentoring, reminds us that the word mentor... Does anybody know where the word mentor comes from? I didn't until I did a little looking. Mentor was the name of a Greek mythology person who Odysseus entrusted to the education of his son. And he entrusted the education of his son to a character named Mentor, who nurtured, supported, and provided counsel for the son. helped the son reach his goals and set his priorities. Well, I think the Apostle Paul understood the critical role of mentoring and leadership development because he reminded the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, he said, "Our gospel came to you not simply with words, but with power and with the Holy Spirit and with deep conviction. You know how we lived among you for your sake. You became imitators of us and of the Lord. In spite of severe suffering, we welcome the message with joy given to us." Paul said, "You brothers and sisters in Thessalonica, you imitated us. We were your mentors." And Paul uses that same phraseology in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, where he says, "Follow or be ye imitators." And it's kind of important, I think, to understand that the chain did not end with the congregation in Thessalonica. Because in verse 7 of that first chapter of 1 Thessalonians, Paul says that the Thessalonians had become a model to all believers in Macedonia and Achaia. So Paul had mentored this congregation, or many of the people in it. They then became, as a congregation and or as individuals, mentors for other Christians throughout the area. Until fairly recently, the concept of mentoring was a part of the fabric of people's everyday life. That's how most people learned. People learned how to shoe a horse by watching somebody else shoe a horse. Ladies, girls learned how to cook by watching somebody else cook. Simply a form of mentoring. And I believe that was natural, and I believe that's the way the early church did it. And we see Paul mentoring numerous people, not the least of which were probably Timothy and Titus. Are leaders born or developed? Well, I think both. But even if we are born with minimal leadership skills, we can develop significant leadership skills. If you happen to have been born with a natural tendency for that, you'll either learn more easily or hopefully you'll learn more and become even a better leader. I thought this quote was appropriate. I don't particularly like the quoter, but I can't always pick and choose. He said, 15% of people succeed in work because of their professional skill, and 85% succeed because of their people skill and knowledge. I believe that. When I was in the secular workplace, I don't know how many people I hired. And I always wanted people with good people skills and good technical skills. But if I had to choose between those two, I would give on technical skills before I would give on people skills, because you can teach technical skills a lot easier than you can teach people skills. Now, I'm not advocating that a good Christian leader is not going to have Bible knowledge, which I would term as technical skills there. But we do need to remember that as we work with people in the church, this is a people business. It is a people business. And if we can't interrelate and be effective with people, it doesn't matter how much we know. And everyone here probably has known somebody that had a lot of Bible knowledge that simply could not somehow get it across. We all have different forms of teaching, so I don't know that one is better than the other, but I know we each have our preferences. I've never been concerned nearly as much with how much material I covered as I've been concerned with how much material I disseminate. Why should I cover 100 points if you can only grasp 5 of them? Shouldn't I cover 20 points and maybe you can grasp 8 of them? Now, if you can cover 100 points and we can grasp 20 of them, then that's even better. But oftentimes I find that very, very difficult. But the Bible is a book of relationships. Not a newsflash, but let me read the words of Jesus here in Mark chapter 12. I'll be there shortly. And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, and perceiving that he had answered them well, asked, "Which is the first commandment of all?" And Jesus answered, "The first of all commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God, And thou shalt love thy Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. And you know what the second commandment was, to love our neighbors. It's relationships. Obviously, those relationships have to be grounded in biblical, scriptural truth. But it is about relationships. I picked a couple of people to look at. This one we'll look at fairly briefly. But the mentoring of Elisha, and I touched on this Sunday afternoon, if you were with us, when we were talking about the picking up of the mantle, which some of you had heard that phrase used by me. Elijah, the senior prophet, if you'll allow me to use that term, was rather depressed. And in 1 Kings chapter 19, we find God giving Elijah some instruction, and one of those instructions was to mentor, if you will, a younger man, Elisha, to take his place. Let me read for you verses 19 through 21 of 1 Kings 19. And he departed and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and mother, and then I will follow you." And he said unto him, "Go back again, for what have I done to thee?" And he returned back from him and took the yoke of the oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with the instruments of the oxen and gave it unto the people, and they did eat. Then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered to him. Well, there are several interesting things, I think, that could be pointed out there, but the one I chose to point out in this context is verse 21. Elisha goes back, he kills the oxen, and what does he use for fuel to cook the oxen? The yoke of the oxen. Here's a man that's burning his past bridges. He not only killed the oxen, he killed the tools that he had used with the oxen. I think one of the important things of developing as a leader is to get rid of a lot of the baggage that is going to keep us from focusing on leadership the way we should. To be able to give our attention in a more fully manner. I don't know a real other reason why he had to use the yoke as the fuel. The killing of the oxen, you could put it under a sacrifice. In 2 Kings chapter 9, or pardon me, chapter 2, verse 9, we find an attitude. And it came to pass when they were gone over that Elijah said unto Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for you before I be taken away from you." And Elisha said, "I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me." Now there's different thoughts as to why he asked for a double portion. Some have counted the miracles that Elijah did, and Elisha did twice as many miracles, so a double portion of spirit, let him do a double portion of miracles. I've never found that terribly compelling. I find it intriguing, but not terribly compelling. But what I do see more compelling here is a young man saying, "I need to be like you, and I'm going to need more help, double portion of the spirit, in order to execute that." I see an element of humility. I see an element of attentiveness. Now I want to talk for a moment about Barnabas. I touched on him, I think, yesterday, but not in the way that I really would like to yet today. And we know Barnabas as a great mentor. Now, having said that, let me ask you, what was it about Barnabas that made him such a good mentor? He was an encourager. Okay. He gave people the benefit of the doubt. He saw potential. Willing to take a risk. He had the desire to help. That's an interesting one. I like that one because I don't think all leaders have that desire. He was generous. You guys are doing great. He was patient with them. Good reputation. They renamed him.
He didn't want to be the most important one.
He didn't want to be the most important one. Dwayne?
I think he promoted his protege there.
He promoted his protege. Yeah, we see that. Remember I talked about Jacob and Esau and Jacob. Well, you see that with Paul and Barnabas and Paul, don't you? Okay, we're going to talk about some of the ones you mentioned. We'll talk about as many of them as you want. I listed a few of them, so I'll make those comments. In the fourth chapter of the book of Acts, and somebody mentioned this, Barnabas, the first encounter that we see with Barnabas has him in an act of generosity, the selling of land and giving it to the church. Now, why would being a generous man be a characteristic that a good mentor would need?
Big heart.
Mentoring involves giving.
Willing to share what information they have.
Willing to share what information he had.
Seeing the need.
Tom says, sharing time. Mentoring is a terribly, terribly time-consuming thing. And it's why it's not always very enjoyable. Anybody else? Generous people, I believe, are also secure. If you're an insecure person, you probably will not be generous. Now, you could feign generosity and still be insecure. But if you're truly a generous person, you are a secure person. And I believe you need to be secure in your own skin in order to be a good mentor. Otherwise, you will feel maybe, dare I say, a little threatened by your protege. You know, Mike said he doesn't mind it if his students are smarter than him. I'll take him at his word. I mean, he knows whether he really feels that way, but that's not the feeling that always prevails. Let's put it that way. It is not the feeling that always prevails. And mentoring begins with a generous heart. Secondly, our next encounter with Barnabas comes in Acts chapter 9, verse 27. And I think it was Tom that said this in slightly different words. It says, Barnabas took him, that was Paul, and brought him to the apostles and declared unto him how he had seen the Lord in a way, and that he had spoken of him, and how he had preached boldly at Damascus in the name of Jesus. Barnabas introduces Paul, who had just not long ago been a chief persecutor of the church, to the brethren at Jerusalem. But Barnabas was looking at the future that Paul had, not at the past. Would you and I? Probably not. I won't answer for you, but probably we would have been like the saints in Jerusalem and remembered Paul primarily as a persecutor rather than as a leader. Barnabas had a radar for potential. Now, I don't know how to teach that radar class, but some people have a gift, and maybe you can develop it, maybe just by reminding ourselves to be more aware of it, but they can see potential in people that you and I don't see it in. That is extremely important in the area of mentoring. And in Acts chapter 15, verse 39, we see that radar up. And the contention was sharp between them, this would be Paul and Barnabas, that they departed asunder one from the other, and so Barnabas took Mark and sailed into Cyprus. And we talked a little bit about this in our confrontation discussion, because I think Barnabas and Paul had a confrontation. Not a doctrinal confrontation, but they certainly saw this situation quite differently. And Barnabas didn't mind being second fiddle. And that's really, really difficult for most of us. Barnabas didn't mind maybe Paul getting the glory. His student, I don't know if I'd call Paul Barnabas a student, but probably he was his junior, at least in the church he was. He doesn't seem to mind at all, and I know you've studied the book of Acts and you've seen that transition from Barnabas and Saul to Paul and Barnabas. That is quite natural. Barnabas put the good of the church ahead of his own prestige. I think Barnabas probably could have written that little song, J-O-Y, Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between. And that's probably a song that we need to take more dearly to heart. All throughout the book of Acts, we see Barnabas encouraging, as Kimber said. Acts chapter 11, verse 23, he's encouraging the brethren. In the first missionary journey, chapter 13, verse 2, he's encouraging. With the John Mark episode, he is encouraging. But it's interesting that I don't think Barnabas picked the champions. I think rather he simply recognized the champions and then worked very patiently with them to develop. Now most of you fall into one of two categories. We've got some, I'll call them middle-aged people here, but a lot of people here are either been in the church a long time or they're just starting out. So we need to very diligently ask ourselves, if you've been in the church several decades, if you're over 40, are you mentoring anybody? Are you mentoring anybody? If you're under 30, are you being mentored by anybody? And I don't know that that means we need to move in with them. Probably doesn't. Probably shouldn't. But there's an element of leadership development that has to be caught rather than taught. That is not the reason why I am against Bible colleges and seminaries, but it is one reason why I think they are so ineffective. People come out with some book knowledge, but it's usually been tainted somewhat by whoever their professors were. But they don't come out with that trench knowledge that I see so much being promoted in the New Testament. Bad leaders would rather keep their followers than develop them. Now notice I said bad leaders. Bad leaders do not want to develop other people. They want to keep them as followers. It's the Diotrephes syndrome that I talked about in 3 John a little bit the other day. I'm going to turn to Luke chapter 6. And I want to just look at a couple of verses, because maybe Christ could give us a little guidance here, you think? In Luke chapter 6, verses 12 through 13, he's getting ready to select his 12 apostles. And it came to pass in those days that he went out into the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer. And when it was day, he called unto him his disciples, and of whom he chose 12, whom also he should name as apostles. Jesus prayed about it. You know, when you see Paul appointing elders in the book of Acts, two things he almost invariably did. He prayed and he fasted. When your congregation is involved in selecting leaders, I sure hope you pray, and I'm going to recommend you fast. I know that fasting is talked about as something that's done very privately, and that's fine. But the need for the Lord's guidance in this process is so, so important. Secondly, he personally mentored them for 3.5 years. You ever wonder why Jesus didn't come and was baptized and crucified in a couple of months? I think this may be one of the most key reasons. The mentoring of these men. I had someone come to me during this study, and I don't want to give you a lot of details because then you'll start figuring out who it was, but it was a man, and his question was, what do I need to do to become an elder? And I get that question periodically, and I imagine others do too. And I shared with you a few days ago, I'm hesitant to give them a list of 1 through 10 because they might go do that list of 1 through 10 and then expect to be put in, and maybe there's more to it. But it is a question that deserves an answer. And I gave the answer that I've got up here as a quote. I mean, this quote's not mine, but it goes along with this quote. I told them, go and get with your current leaders and tag along. Now, that doesn't exclude learning the Bible, but nothing is going to take the place of going with someone who's experienced and visiting the sick. Or when it's appropriate, going with someone who's done it before to visit a delinquent member. I don't know how to teach that out of a textbook. I don't think it can be taught out of a textbook. I don't think it really should be. I mean, you can put some bullet points up in a PowerPoint presentation and talk about it, but that's not the way you learn this. I thought Gene Wilkes had it pretty good. You will never be an effective leader until you include those you lead with what you do. Now, that's almost another way of, it's not delegation, but it's close to it. Would it be easier for you as a seasoned servant of the Lord to go call on somebody by yourself and not have some wet behind the ears pipsqueak? Sure it would. Do you have trepidation that they're liable to stick their foot and your foot in their mouth? Sometimes. Well, you can tell them to hush. Now, they may not, but I think usually they will. But that is how you learn. My dad's dead now, so I can tell this. But when I was growing up, we had a living room, and then all the bedrooms were right off the living room. Well, what happens is sometimes the elders or church leaders would come to our house and they'd have a church meeting. And I was usually told it was bedtime. So I'd go to my room. But you can be amazed what you can hear through that door, especially if your ear is right there. Now, I'm not recommending this, but I was probably 7, 8, 9 years old, and I bet I'm not the only one here that's done that, okay? And I couldn't tell you today any of the specifics of the things were discussed, but I do still remember to this day that learning process of listening to godly men work through issues. Do I think the church is worse off now than then? Not at all. I just think it's our problem and not theirs. I really do. I don't think it's worse off. I don't know if it's better off. I don't think it's worse off. Now, I'm not recommending that modus operandi because that wasn't me at my highest level of integrity. But at that age, it was even lower than it is today. So you deal with it. But the point is that learning process. Okay? I never minded being a child in a home that had a lot of that activity. I found it, and to my credit, I never repeated anything I heard, and I don't know that I ever heard anything that really bothered me, except when someone got up and started walking, and I wondered if they were coming to my door, so I'd scramble back in bed. But we do have that curiosity, don't we? We do have that curiosity. Well, let's use that to our benefit. And I'm not talking just about the men. Ladies, when Paul tells Titus, older women teach the younger, it doesn't have to be in front of a blackboard. Take them when you're doing your good works and let them learn how to do it. That's mentoring. That's developing leaders. Does it take a little more time and have a little risk factor? Of course. But the alternative is not doing it. And when you are gone, what's going to happen then? I believe there are numerous congregations suffering today because they don't have leaders because they never did anything to try to encourage and develop it. Now, God gives the increase. God blesses us. I'm not taking him out of the equation. I just think it's a tremendously, tremendously important thing to do. Now, some of you here were mentored Tom Woody was mentored by several. Others have traveled with people and spent time, but it's not just evangelists that need to be mentored. I never did it quite that way because I started at a different age in a different situation. But that can be positive. I've had young men come and spend a week with me or so. They'll have to tell you how whether it was positive or not, but it was the right thing to do. Was it cumbersome? Did I get less done that week? Well, I got less of my stuff done that week. I'll say that. I don't know that I got less done, but I'd get up and say, well, how am I going to keep them busy this morning? Or how am I going to, I felt this obligation, but yet it is part of the learning process. But it needs to be in the deacons. If you're a deacon, take a young man with you when you're going on a benevolent call. Let him learn. And observe whether or not that's an area where he has talent. See, it's not a one-way street. How else are we going to tell what people's talents are unless we give them a chance to develop them and use them? So, I think the Bible gives us a very good way of developing leaders. I'm going to pause and see if anybody has a comment or a question on this you would like to make before I have a couple of closing paragraphs on this. Doug?
I appreciate what you said about God giving the increase, but the first part of that is somebody planted and somebody watered.
Excellent. The first part of that, God giving the increase, was somebody planted and somebody watered. And we normally, rightfully, probably take that in terms of evangelism, but I don't know why that doesn't also apply to leadership. I'm sometimes asked by young men, not young men there, but young men here, do you have to be a deacon before you can be an elder? Well, the answer is no. I wasn't, but I do see some tremendous benefits of it. And one of those benefits is being able to be in on some of those conversations that the officers might have, and it is a learning process. Because you may be too old to stick your ear to the bedroom door of your father's house and listen. And I don't think he ever knew I did that. Well, let me rephrase that. I know he never knew I did that. But it is an important learning process. Charles.
Can you address the benefit and the risk of congregation observing and discussions and so forth? I'm just looking at that as far as officers, like parents. I don't think bad for kids to see parents disagree as long as they're kept in a constructive situation where they find out that, well, yeah, things do disagree and they get over it. This is how they get over it, instead of it being such a unified kind all the time. They have no idea what to do with disagreement.
Okay, I'm going to repeat that, and you correct me if I don't capture it. I think I heard him say, could I comment on allowing people to see maybe some of the discussions about officership or issues when there's not total harmonious agreement? Yeah, I think there is some benefit to that in the proper context. Let me talk about it from a family context first, and this is not necessarily the way to deal with your kids. When our boys were young, and I'm going to put young at like 15 and below, we tried to be very careful not to overly discuss church things in their presence because they can get a very sour taste in their mouth. But I made a conscious decision not to share with them confidential material, but when they got to be in their late teens and certainly into their 20s, to share some of that with them so they would have a realistic view of the church as they became adults. And I think for us it worked. Now, different temperaments and different families. But I don't think we want to just share all of our bitter feelings about somebody in front of our kids. Well, we shouldn't share those in front of anybody. We ought to swallow them and chew them up and get rid of them. In a church setting, if it's done in a loving, civil manner, I think it can be instructive for people to see. The danger is it can become uncivil and unloving, so we have to use some real judgment there. But And you didn't ask me about homeschooling, and I don't know what I think about homeschooling, but what popped into my head is one of my concerns about homeschooling, if it's not addressed, is our children can grow up in this bubble and not see the world.
Yeah.
Now, I think you can homeschool and avoid that. I've seen families avoid that and do very well, but sometimes I've seen that bubble, and I didn't want my boys to grow up in such a bubble that when it came their time to lead, officially or unofficially, they were totally unprepared. Well, you mean they disagree? Well, sure they do, unless we're clones of each other. Do you have a follow-up or have a thought on that, Charles?
Yeah, I think if the environment can be positive and love between, if it's the officers judging something or studying something, maybe they don't completely agree and they're trying to sort it out or whatever, because it's in a loving frame, that would be very beneficial for the rest of the group to see, because they don't sometimes they don't get a chance to see the trying to dig and sort out what the Bible teaches about something. They just see the final product, they don't know how to get there.
Yeah. I hope you could hear him, because I'm not going to be able to totally do that justice. But I think there can be some constructive benefit if we control it. We just can't keep people isolated. The world is the world. The church is the church. Anybody else have a comment or a question you would like to make on this? Janice.
The quote you just had up there about including the people you're trying to lead.
Mm-hmm.
What was going through my mind was my mother used to be a cook. I asked her how to make something, and she couldn't really describe it to me, but she said just watch me. And that's how I learned. And then later when I looked at a cookbook, the things the cookbook said, they weren't necessary.
Sure.
So like the theory you're getting it from the class is good, but until you try it and see it, you're never really going to be able to absorb it.
Yeah. Let me make this comment to the younger people. I don't know how to define that. When you're with someone that, quote, is kind of teaching you, you will not only learn how to do things, you will also, if you're alert, learn how not to do things. And often we learn how not to do them before we learn how to do them. I'm going to go through this one a little quickly, because I've got another one I want to get to. But it struck me, even Paul was sent to another person to learn what to do. The Lord could have given him a mind zap, but he didn't. Leadership can be taught, but it also must be modeled. And I think it's easier caught than taught. We need both. But I believe I had the privilege when I was first put in as an elder to serve with five other elders, all of which were older than me. And it was like going to school, not in a classroom setting, but in an informal mentoring setting, and I have cherished those 4 years I had with those men. I've already said that. New Testament leader development, I think, was by working together in the trenches. I'm changing directions now, so if you have anything to say on leader development, this may be your last chance in this class setting. I don't think Kylie writes with us right now. This is mine and Kylie's favorite subject. I touched on this just a little bit at Eminence, and Kylie came up to me after the class and said, I remember about 5 years ago you said something about that. Well, anybody that can remember anything anybody says that long is kind of impressive. One of the reasons, and this does tie to leadership development, but it's for all of us. One of the biggest problems I think we have is this foolish illusion of busyness. Now, I did not say you're not busy. I just consider it to be a foolish illusion that, pardon me, I'm finding it more nauseous the more I think about it. I think it's becoming an epidemic and a disease, not only in our society, but we're part of our society, so it's becoming, I think, an epidemic and a disease. And one of the reasons maybe we don't develop leaders or aren't doing it is we think we're too busy. Our plates are so full. You ever gone up to someone and said, well, I haven't seen you for a while. What have you been up to? 9 times out of 10, you're going to hear these words. Well, I've been busy. I think that's an off-the-hook response. I don't know what that means. I almost don't care, but I don't know what that means. Busyness, I believe, has, is, put whatever verb you want, become the opium of choice for a lot of people who want to escape responsibility. I'm too busy. Hogwash. You got the same amount of hours and days as the person sitting next to you. You're just choosing to use them different. Sometimes we'll say, well, I'm so too busy, as if all of our neglect is forgiven by that simple statement. It's not my fault. I'm too busy. Well, it's our fault if we're too busy. So, yeah, it is our fault. I put a quote up here that I disagree with. Pleased is the man who is too busy to worry in the daytime and too sleepy to worry at night. I don't believe that's the life of a good or a great leader. If we are too busy to worry in the daytime, then we're too busy. Now, I know the Bible tells us not to worry, but we've got responsibilities that we have to deal with. My favorite quote of the 2 weeks, Donald Blesch, busyness is the new holiness. That's my favorite quote of all classes, well, of my class. And what he meant by that is we have adopted this attitude that if we're busy, that's pleasing to the Lord. I don't know what could be more wrong than that. And some of you have heard me say this, and I don't apologize for it. Busyness is not a virtue. The virtue comes in what we're busy about. Faith is not a virtue. The virtue comes in the object of our faith. Otherwise, a Buddhist would be as virtuous as a Christian. Do not get a big high out of being busy. Please. Robert Levin said, and I didn't put this up, it's a little long, and I didn't want to get finger cramp. If you casually greet Americans with the question of how are you, they're liable to say, tell you how busy their life is. Perhaps scrunching up their faces and bodies to show how anxious and stressed they are. The odd thing about this, he says, is that both parties probably realize that it's a type of bragging. Look how important I am, because I am busy. How busy I am has nothing to do with whether I'm important or not. Now, I carry one of these. It's off, because I'd never hear the end of it if it went off right now. And I use it. You use it. But I am convinced most people... No. I am convinced more people have one of these, not because they need it, but because it makes them look and feel important. I believe that. Am I against them? No, or I wouldn't have one. Oh, I'm just so busy, I can't be out of contact with anybody. They might need me. Well, I think that's a real dilemma. How many people were too busy to be here these 2 weeks? Now, I don't want us to be judgmental, and some of them probably were and couldn't make it. But how many people could have been here and convinced themselves that they were too busy? Well, if they were, God bless them. But if they weren't, busyness is not an automatic or even always a desirable trait of great leaders. It often describes someone who has gotten lost in the daily detail rather than gotten lost in the eternal significance. Busyness is often somebody who has gotten lost in the daily detail and lost sight of the eternal significance. Or the person that misses the forest for the trees. Michael Zeglarly did a survey, and he surveyed 752 Christian leaders, and I'm using that term in its broadest scope, okay? People who at least profess the belief in God. In the way of your developing a relationship with God, that's the question he asked. 39% of those people said almost always. 36% said often. 11% said sometimes. 14% said rarely. Now, we can quibble about those numbers, but it's a slam dunk. Even people who profess a belief in God and may well have a belief in God admit that busyness gets in their way of developing a relationship with God. Now, what is important enough to keep us from developing that relationship? If busyness derails our Christian walk, then where are we? John Ortberg said, "We must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from our lives." Carl Jung said, "Hurry is not of the devil. Hurry is the devil." Now, I don't expect you all to agree with me. That's fine. But let me ask you this. Do you think Jesus was a hurried man on earth? Terribly productive, terribly efficient, but I don't think he was hurried. You think he would have had call waiting? I've got it. No slams. I like it because then I don't have to answer it if I don't want to. Let me look. Yeah, good. I'm just in great shape on time. I want to look at a couple of passages. Ecclesiastes chapter 2 is the first one. Solomon is obviously an intriguing man. You're familiar with him, most all of you. And I want to look at the first 10 or 11 verses. I'm going to read them. I'm going to take the time to read them, even though my time is coming short. Solomon here, probably describing some form of hedonism in his life. He says, chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, "I said in my heart, go now, I will prove thee with mirth, and therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this is also vanity. And I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in my heart to give myself to wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold of folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons." Verse 4, "I made great works. I builded my houses. I planted my vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards. I planted trees. I made pools of water. I got me servants and maidservants. Also I had great possessions. I gathered me also silver and gold." You get the gist of this. We're talking about one busy dude. One busy dude. And then what does he conclude? It's all... That's his conclusion. Until we get to the last chapter. A busy, busy, busy. Be busier than I am, busier than you are. Wives, 300 concubines, a busy man. 1 Kings chapter 10. Just a couple of verses. 22. For the king had at sea a navy of Tarshish with the navy of Hiram. Once in 3 years came the navy of Tarshish built, bringing gold and silver. So the king of Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and wisdom. And all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom. And they brought every man his present, vessels, silver, vessels of gold. He was a busy man. That was the first half of his life, roughly. But you know from the book of Ecclesiastes and other writings that he changed. I believe Solomon in the first half of his life, and I'm not putting that right at that middle year, but the first part of his life, success was what this man was after. So he was busy, busy, busy chasing whatever he considered to be success. The last part of his life, he spent it seeking significance. Because significance is so much more important than success. And busyness is not always the way for significance to be achieved. And then, of course, we reach that great conclusion in the 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes. Verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of God. Which are we? Busy or productive? Which are we after? Success or significance? In order for me to be a successful parent, my kids have to participate in everything possible. Hogwash. In order for me to be a successful parent, my kids can't participate in everything possible. In order for me to be a successful businessman, I have to read every business journal I can get my hands on. Now, you're not going to agree with everything I'm getting ready to say. Not that you've agreed with anything or everything I have said. But let me at least share it with you. I believe busyness is selfishness. When you go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, maybe you got that inference as I read. Verse 1, I said in my heart, I will prove. Verse 2, I said of laughter. Verse 3, I sought my heart. You count the I's in those 10 or 11 verses and you're going to have a bunch of them. It's just repeatedly. Busy people are I people. 99% of the time. Now, I'm not advocating that we become slothful and lazy. I am challenging us to have the right object of our busyness. That's what I'm really challenging. Secondly, busy people have a great tendency to value results over people. And if we're not careful, that can happen in the church. Remember, this is a people business, and I don't really like the word business. This is a people organization. What good does it do your congregation if you memorize the whole Bible and don't encourage the people? Well, obviously, very little. What benefit, before I get to that one, what benefit does it do if I provide for my family and leave them $1 million to split amongst them if I haven't shared the Lord with them? Well, a rhetorical question, isn't it? I believe people that, quote, are busy are usually a slave to a schedule. And I empathize with them because I am somewhat too. And I need a schedule to keep me from being overly slothful. I need deadlines. I know exactly what I'm going to work on next week. But I couldn't start it till I got this week over with. Because I'm not one-track mind, but a little bit. But we can become slaves to a schedule rather than slaves to God. I think busyness is usually an illusion, and let me comment on that. We either think we're busy, or we probably more, we like to think we're busy because we think busy is virtuous. Most of us have automatic transmissions. Maybe a few of you still, or you got a truck. I had an old truck. I just gave it to Goodwill 2 weeks ago. Well, it was to the Cancer Society, but it was a good cause. And it was it had, you know, the old shifteroos. And you got first gear, second gear, third gear, fourth gear, fifth gear, and R, which stood for reverse. Most people live their lives in two gears, first and fifth. They either go so fast till they fizzle out, then they got to go rest in first gear, and then they go as fast as they can. Could it be there's some virtue in running our lives in third and fourth gear rather than simply first and fifth? It's back to that virtue of fifth gear. I believe Christian leaders should have some productive leisure. They should have time for relationship building. Some of you have asked me what I'm going to do next week. Well, you know I've got an appointment Sunday because I mentioned that vis-a-vis a baptism. But I'm going to tell you, and I'm not embarrassed by this, what I'm going to do come Monday. Not much by many standards, but I am going to do a couple of things that are real important to me. I'm going to spend time with my wife. Am I going to be busy? Well, you'll find me in my old cutoffs. Well, you won't, because if you come to the door, I'll change clothes. But if you could get in without me knowing it, you'd find me in my old cutoffs and my T-shirt with my tie. I almost might look like Charles Fry, but I just can't quite go that far. No. You know what I'm saying? So that I'll have a little bit of something when I go to the next whatever you would call my job is. I'm going to urge you to do that. I hope the people at Vandalia sleep for 3 weeks. I do. I mean, they can't. But I hope you understand what I'm trying to say. Sometimes I think Jesus led a very balanced life. And oftentimes we don't lead a balanced life. We lead a first gear, fifth gear life. Gordon MacDonald wrote, "A driven person is most often gratified by accomplishments. Always reading books and attending seminars that promise to use what time he or she has more effectively. Why? So he can produce more accomplishments, which will in turn produce greater gratification." Now that's a fifth gear person. I didn't write this in my notes, so I won't recite it right, but you're going to get the gist of this unless I totally butcher it. How hard people work to get enough money so they can buy things to make them look young again. And if they hadn't worked at such a pell-mell pace, maybe they wouldn't have looked so old so quick. Now, boy, I didn't do that justice, but I hope you got the gist of that. Please. I used to be in sales, and when you travel with a salesman that was training you, they'd always try to teach you how to do bang, 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 you know, 14 calls a day. And there's some truth to that. I went with this one old salesman. He's probably dead now. I got in the car. He said, "I'm going to teach you how to relax." I liked him. That sounded good. No, he took it to an extreme. I think leaders need to feel not only that it's okay, but that it's necessary to take a deep breath and regroup, recharge. And I think we'll be more effective leaders when we do that. Where in the Bible has God called you and I to be more productive? He's called us to the work, but He's never given us any quotas. Again, I'm not talking slothfulness. I think God calls me more to faithfulness than He does productiveness. If I am faithful, then the production will come. We get so preoccupied with symbols of accomplishment. If you've worked in an office, I bet you have seen people measure the cubic feet in their office and compare it to other people. That's a status symbol. It's a status symbol. If you've got a 15 by 15 office, you are more important than anybody who has a 10 by 10 office. And if you have an office instead of a cubicle, you're way more important than them. That is the way we think, isn't it? Well, I think busyness is often the road to ethical compromise. We had a lesson on compromise Wednesday night. We get in a hurry and we make compromises. And sometimes they have spiritual significance. There's more to life than running and standing. There is such a thing as walking. Remember Psalms 1, blessed is the man who walketh. Didn't say necessarily running or standing, just a good steady pace. There needs to be a walking and a balance. I do not believe Jesus was a hurried man. I'm not convinced if he lived in our day and age, he would own a cell phone. I don't know that. Do I think it's wrong? No, I wouldn't have one. I got a laptop. I'm getting almost as bogged down as any of you. There's a few of you that are got some gadgets that I still want. So I'm talking to me. I'm talking to me. I do not feel tired at all. But I know I am. And I know what's going to happen tomorrow evening. God is going to say, are you still alive? And I will be. And some of you have heard me say this. I'm just saying, please, please, our productivity, our leadership, all these things we've talked about, these, I think, can really improve by simply allowing ourselves to focus on the important rather than the urgent. As the first one to put one of those boxes up here. I think Jesus knew when to rest. He knew when to work. And great leaders are balanced and productive. Hurried people sometimes become, if not start out, very competitive. They can have volcanic tempers. And the obsessively busy usually have very poor relationships. Because relationships take time. If I were giving a class on marriage, which I'm not this year, I would say marriages are like our body. And if you don't work them, they start to sag. But that's true of all relationships, isn't it? And that's true of the relationships we have within our congregations and within our churches. I'm going to pause there. We're about going to stop. Does anybody have a comment or a question? I know that was a little soapboxy, but I feel strongly about it, so I don't apologize. Lowell.
Kind of go down to my thought, which you were saying we're too busy. Some of us are too busy because we're not organized enough, and you mentioned productivity or right wing. Now, some of us can not be doing anything and still be busy.
Lowell says, I mentioned productivity, and maybe part of our problem is we're not organized. And if I caught your last statement, it was, we can be busy and not accomplishing anything. Yeah.
Yeah,
Is that, that's kind of what you said. Yeah, that's very true. Simply being busy doesn't necessarily accomplish anything, and maybe some organization would help. Would help.
Disciplined, but I mean, I felt I had to be so disciplined when I was taking care of mom that, you know, it wasn't really suicidal, but it did affect you.
Did you find that was good or bad?
I felt like it was something that just needed to be endured.
Okay. Well, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Obviously, taking care of our parents is something that is our obligation to do, but I suspect that focus caused your busyness to be somewhat productive because you had several irons in the fire at the time. Oh, I'm sure that that's the answer to that. But, yeah, just running around, you know, that's the old chicken with our heads off. If you ladies could have half the time back that you spend carting yahoos all over the place, think what you could do. And it's not that that's wrong. I coached Little League Baseball for 10 years. I'm a competitive man. We played twice a week, practiced three times a week. Well, there went my week. It was amazing how much time I had when we quit. And again, I am not saying don't do it. I'm just saying I was busy. Would I have been better off a little bit busier here and a little bit less busy on ground balls? Maybe. No. Yes, I would have been. But we have to have our recreation too. But don't get caught up in, I'm just so busy, busy, busy. Well, yeah, we all are. Get caught up in making sure you're busy in something that has more eternal significance, be it your family, be it in the Word like Jay was teaching us, or with our children as Mark was. His subject wasn't children, but the topic had to do probably with the young people, and that was very good. Anybody else want to make a comment before I run over? Doug and then Ginger. Busy, he heard described as burdened under Satan's yoke. That often is true, but I think we can be busy for the Lord, and you do too. Ginger?
Yeah, I ask it humbly because I have found myself kind of in the busyness of life. And
welcome to it.
I like to send cards to people, and I like to encourage them, and I understand just sending cards is enough, but I don't want that answer. What are suggestions that you might make to help them see that the physical busyness in life is not as important as the spiritual busyness?
Have who see? Anybody or your kids or yes?
In general, anyone.
I think that her question was, there's things we can do, but what can we do to help people see that spiritual busyness is more important than physical busyness, if I understood her question. I
actually, I'm asking specifically, maybe even what can I put in their cards to help them? Help them see
what can she put in cards of encouragement she sends to help people see that? Anybody got an idea? I'm not a card person, so I'm you ought to ask my wife. Kimber? Bible verses? Yeah. It would seem to me, being a man, which I'm not a card-oriented person like you ladies probably are, a short spiritual statement like I'm praying for you or may the Lord be with you probably is much more effective than a long sermon. Who? Tom?
The things you're saying about busyness, can we apply those to the weeds and the parable of the sword?
Yeah. He said, can we apply the weeds and the parable of the sword to busyness? Yes.
They grow, but they're not.
Nancy, and then I'm going to think a little more on your question because we haven't given you a good answer. I haven't. Nancy?
Some of Donna's cards in particular, it's just
knowing that somebody was, that you were thinking of them.
Yeah.
It's not so much what you say.
I'm going to step away from the mic, and I hope you won't mind me sharing this, Nancy. I don't think you would, but... Now, I want to end on... This is kind of a bad on me, but Donna McNeese just had a pacemaker put in. Well, my wife found out about that Tuesday, so Donna's card got here yesterday. And I can't remember the exact lyrics, but it said something like, I want to put a little sunshine in your life, but I sent John instead. So, I don't get no respect. You're dismissed.